we've been trying to tell better stories about women and clergy and the church, because we really need to tell better stories. Instead of just complaining about it, what if we flood the airwaves with something different? Hello, friends, and welcome back to the podcast. And I'm Joanne, host of This Is Her Story. I'm working on a second podcast right now. And I think I named them the names are too similar, because now I have to think about which one am I recording. But this is the next installment of the Deconstruction series. I have a couple more interviews coming up. Dr. Brent Neely is coming to the podcast. We're going to talk about his book, Ancient Prayers, and the early church, and how connecting with the early church might help us through our deconstruction process. And then I have Mark Karras coming to the podcast, and we're going to talk about religious trauma, healing from a religious trauma in particular, and we're also going to talk about the doctrine of hell, in particular, eternal fire, burning in hell for eternity, theology, and how that is detrimental to our psyches and how it has damaged so many people. And then down the road, I hope to have somebody else come on to talk about some alternative theology to eternal damnation. But in the meantime, I want to do a couple episodes where I share some stories of some of the things that got me started on this deconstruction journey. And I'm just hoping that as I share my story, that it will resonate with you. You'll see some of your own experiences, recognize some of these things. Maybe it's normative. And I think as we hear other people talk about their deconstruction stories, that there's a sense of relief in, you know, there's a little bit of this that's normative. And in Mark Karras's, he's written several books. He has one called Religious Refugees. And in that book, he was talking about how deconstruction is really, it's not something that anybody goes looking for. Like, it just kind of happens. And I think I talk about this in an episode a couple episodes ago, that for most people, when they begin deconstructing, is that it really kind of starts with an experience that causes cognitive dissonance. And so you have an experience that's very real, but now it doesn't line up with your faith, the things that you have been taught. And so you either have to do some mental gymnastics to somehow make the pieces connect, or you just have, I guess you have a couple of options, right? One of them is you can do some mental gymnastics to figure out how the two things can coincide together at the same time. Or you can just gaslight yourself, or allow the church to gaslight you and say, no, that experience wasn't really real. It wasn't legit. You need to just forget about it and move on, which the church, of course, is very good at doing. Or you can begin asking questions, wrestling with doubts, and that is really where it begins. I think there's a tipping point. Like, I think you start with the whole this asking questions and doubting and wrestling with stuff, and then maybe you find a way to, I guess, justify the experience. And then maybe you fall back into, I can still walk this path. Or maybe you tweak a few aspects of your faith over here. And then you just kind of like ignore that this part is different. But I think there's a tipping point then that really says, I can no longer function in my right mind with this cognitive dissonance. I have to make some changes. I have to change some of my beliefs because they don't line up. I think mostly because you feel like you're going crazy. And so there were several, I think, key moments. I'll talk about the tipping point for me in a couple of episodes down the road. I mentioned it a little bit in the few episodes, the intro episode called You Are Here. And I talked about a pastor failing, a mentor friend of mine, having a moral failing. And that was like one of the tipping points. But then there was another thing that happened that was really left me with this, man, I've been the good girl and played by the rules. And what did it get me? That was really the tipping point. I want to go way back to some of the things that started really bothering me. So there are a couple of them. One was my sister-in-law was 8.5 months pregnant and had a stillborn baby. And at the same time that we were kind of going through this, and we all gathered around her because she had to go. They were going to induce labor, and she was going to have to give birth to her daughter, even though she was already gone. So we all gathered around her at their house and laid hands on her and prayed. And I remember really asking God, I'm like, you know, God, you can raise the dead. And you're a father, right? Of course, it did not happen. And so the next day she went in, and Claire was already deceased, and It was a very tender moment. We were all able to be with her after Claire was delivered and get to hold Claire. And, you know, we dedicated her to the Lord. What was difficult for me, obviously holding my dead niece was difficult. But theologically, what was bothering me was that we had a mutual acquaintance at the time who just found out she was pregnant, I think, with her third child. This person, it was very obvious that there was neglect and probably abuse in that home. And I could not wrap my brain around the fact that God would give a child, another child, into this abusive home, but then taking my sister-in-law and brother-in-law's daughter from them. And that really became one of the moments where I just said, this, something's not right. Like, you know, I think there's some people who would have moved into this phase of, well, is God even real? Does God hear our prayers, et cetera, et cetera. But for me, I think what I started to question was some of the things I have been taught. It wasn't about whether or not God was real as much as it was about some of the theology that I have been taught. And that kind of began some of the questioning for me. But the big one for me was several years ago, my husband and I got a phone call from our niece, and her name was Grace, and she said that she was coming to town the next day, and she just really wanted to see all of the family, but that she wanted us to know that she had been taking hormone therapy for about the last 18 months to 2 years, and that she had changed her legal name, and that she was now our nephew. And so we kind of had 24 hours to get our minds around this. I think there were a lot of elements to it that caused cognitive dissonance. One, I mean, 24 hours, like all of a sudden, I don't have a niece anymore. I have a nephew. And then finding out that several people in the family already knew that this was happening. They had known for over a year, but nobody had bothered to tell us that this was happening. And then to complicate matters more, my transgender nephew's mom had told them that my husband and I would not understand, and that we would be judgmental and hateful and reject him. So we did have a good interaction the next day, and he said that, you know, maybe he was wrong. Maybe some of the advice and the information he had received about us was wrong. And we tried to connect up for several months after that. And I think it was just too difficult for him. And he really cut himself off from all of the family, really, except for his mom. anyway, he's thriving and doing well to the best of my knowledge right now, just from what I know from my other niece and nephew and my brother-in-law, that he's doing well. Matter of fact, he's gotten his master's degree and he's counseling and he's helping others through their wrestling and struggling with LGBTQ issues. But that wasn't the part that caused me to start asking questions about my faith. We loved him and we still love him, and we would definitely be open to a relationship with him. No strings attached, right? Like, not to get him to change, not to do that just because he's our nephew. But it was shortly after that, maybe, I don't know, maybe even a month after that, that I had a ministry experience. We do a thing on my district called Ministry Assessment Center Weekend. And so anybody who's preparing to answer the call to ministry, they'll have this Ministry Immersion Weekend. That might be the best way to explain it. It's a Ministry Immersion Weekend before you actually receive your first minister's license. Anyway, one of the things that we do on that weekend is we have what's called a case study. And so a semi-fictional situation is presented. Usually they are actual experiences, but they've been tweaked a little bit. Anyway, and so as a group, you will read this case study, this story. You kind of have to make decisions. You talk about it. You make some decisions. As the pastor, how would you handle the situation? Those kind of things. We're not necessarily looking for right answers. It really is more about understanding your strengths and your weaknesses and how you lead and those kind of things. But this particular case study that we were in dealt with an LGBTQ issue. And so here I am trying to, with my other ministry partner, lead a group through this discussion, sit back and objectively observe what's happening while also having this very fresh experience and also listening to, I don't want to say hate speech, but very judgmental language used. And I could not help but to think about my nephew in the story. What if my nephew went to one of these churches? What if my nephew decided to show up on the doorstep and sit in a pew and hear a sermon? And would he be received? Would he be loved? Would he be welcomed as who he is? Or would he be told that he will burn in hell for all eternity? Will he be rejected? Will he be told turn or burn? You know, like, how will he be loved and received? I was so overwhelmed and there was so much anxiety. I know I had several anxiety attacks that weekend. And so for me, what I started to do was, okay, I have an opportunity to love other people's transgender sons and daughters. And so that really became my ministry, right? Like, I'm going to love on all these LGBTQ people. I can't do it for my nephew because he doesn't want to have anything to do with his family right now, but I can do it for somebody else, right? I can be somebody else's aunt and love them. I don't want to say a stand-in for my nephew, but in a sense of, here's what I can do, right? If I can't love on my nephew, I can love on somebody else's nephew or somebody else's niece is wrestling with or embraced, already embraced LGBTQ lifestyle. And so that really became my journey. Like, I was already struggling with some of the stuff, but I thought, you know, I can make it my mission to love LGBTQ people, until it became obvious that even loving LGBTQ people isn't acceptable. For whatever reason, God has brought LGBTQ people across my path and my husband's path. I think it is because of my nephew. I think, I made a commitment to God. I'm like, I will love other people's LGBTQ nieces and nephews if you will send somebody into my nephew's life that he can trust, that will love on him in the same way. And so I think that God honored that and began sending several LGBTQ people my way. And it really became important for my husband and I to create a safe place for people. And then sometime around 2020, it became obvious that even loving and showing grace and mercy to LGBTQ people was outside of the limits of our denomination, my denomination. We had an art fair on the front lawn of our church, and we just invited anybody in the neighborhood who had a side hustle. We'll give you a table for free, set it up. We're going to pass out ice cream and water, and it's just an opportunity to connect, have FaceTime with our community in a time when nobody was having FaceTime with anybody, right? Like everybody was shut down in 2020. And we had like 10 or 12 different vendors come, and they were all different kind of things. Some, you know, there was like somebody selling doTERRA and somebody selling books, and somebody had paintings, and other people had crafts. And so we didn't care. We were just like, just come. It was fantastic because of where we're located in our situation, our building in the middle of a neighborhood, that we had about 120 people come through, 120 people that we got to talk to and minister to and just love on in our community. One of the groups who decided to use the table is PFLAG, a group called PFLAG, parents and families of LGBTQ children. And so they were selling crafts and stuff like that. We had no control. People could do whatever they wanted with their money. Some people were putting it in their pocket because they had lost their jobs, and so they were trying to just pay the bills. Other people decided that they wanted to raise money for fun. It was a fundraiser for them, and it was going to help them with whatever. My daughter was selling her paintings so that she could pay for her education. And the PFLAG group was going to take any of the money that they raised, and they were going to support the Trevor Project, which is a project that provides counseling for LGBTQ youth who are suicidal. And another church on my district called my DS and told them that I was having a fundraiser for gay people and that I was no longer in compliance with the manual of my denomination, the bylaws of my denomination, which of course was a fallacy. That was not what we were doing. They could have called me up. They know who I am. They have my phone number. They could have Facebooked me, whatever. But rather than seeking out the truth, they chose to make up something else about what we were doing. And that's when I began to realize that even loving LGBTQ people was going to give you grief. And it really started to push me over the edge. Is that for some of you who are deconstructing, maybe you've already deconstructed, or you're starting to feel this cognitive dissonance. Closer you are to Jesus, the more you truly want to love the way that he loves. I don't think you can avoid deconstruction, because you will run into someone who will tell you that those people you're not allowed to love. It's okay if you love these people over here, but you can't love these people over here. Or if you really loved them, you would tell them and warn them about how they're going to hell. I don't see that from Jesus. I've read the Gospels quite a bit. I think that as evangelicals, we have chosen to worship Paul over Jesus, and that we need to get back to the Gospels. As a matter of fact, there's a former general superintendent of my denomination who said that if you preach from nothing but the Gospels for the rest of your ministry, you'd probably be doing your congregation a favor, which I think is ironic, because the building that we're in, the church who had it before us, their last pastor only preached from the Gospels. And I always thought to myself, that's so strange that you only preach from the Gospels and not the rest of it. And now I'm like, yeah, I understand why he only preached from the Gospels. I don't know that we need, I mean, I know that we need the rest of the scriptures. I'm not like, oh, throw the rest of the Bible out. But at the same time, I'm like, you know what? Anything left of Matthew and anything right of John, it would help us a lot right now if we just ignored those and spent the majority of our time fixed on those four gospels and what they have to tell us about Jesus and how we love one another. I'll share more. There's more stories that I have. I want to share a little bit about my friend Mike Goot that really changed my understanding of my philosophy of ministry. And then there's probably some other stories I want to share. But I thought that this might be a good place to start. And I imagine that there's parts of this story that you're like, oh yeah, I've been there. And I guess I just want to give you permission to wrestle with stuff, permission to be angry, permission to be sad, permission to be disappointed, permission to grieve, permission to think this, all of this is stupid. I think that many times I'm like, well, this is a big pile of poo-poo. Anyway, that's what I have for you today. A couple of interviews coming down the pike. And I will talk to you soon.